Let's talk about age and how relative it is. And just in passing to begin with, a $10 bet at the TAB has netted a $300,000 windfall for a Dunedin man who says he's too old to spend his winnings. Len Glassford is 73. In 20 years' time, Steve, oh no, I'll be generous, in 30 years' time, do you think you'll still be able to spend like your accountant's not watching?
I mean, without breaking a sweat. What gets me about this, though, is, you know, so often on the panel we have discussions of the evils of pokies, because we accept that gambling is a dodgy thing and that gambling is a societal evil. Why are we celebrating this?
How do you mean celebrating it?
So, well,
why not celebrate someone's good luck?
Well, because it promotes gambling, and we've established that gambling is a social evil. Unless we're saying that gambling on the horses is, well, that's what the classier people do. Own the lower orders gamble on pokies, and therefore we're going to protest against those. There's a huge double standard at work
here. But there's a good argument for gambling on the horses, because you're supporting a whole horse industry, a whole thoroughbred industry.
Well, as opposed to supporting
staff,
the whole
on racetracks,
Sky City industry, yeah.
Or with lotto and things, you're actually supporting community charity work.
Yeah, it's true.
Those sorts of things.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, what we really want to talk about is this notion, which has been widely publicised today, of a new apartment complex designed exclusively for baby boomers, who are guaranteed no random tenants disrupting their lives. Lawyers, so you have to be 50 plus, or one of you does. You're allowed a younger partner. I'm not sure about the children, but I presume you're allowed them too. Lawyers say the developers of this Xanadu complex on the Auckland CBD fringe, lawyers say the developers are opening themselves up to complaints because it's against the law to refuse to sell property to someone because of their age. Yeah. Michael Bott will come on, attempt to sort this out for us. Do you see it as ageist?
Of course it is. Look, Human Rights Act, Section 50, Section 21, I looked this up on the way, I was very, very thorough in my show prep here, that forbids discrimination on the basis of age. You say only that there has to be somebody over a certain age, then it's ageist. Of course it is. It also appeals to people who obviously have recollections of that dreadful ELO and Olivia Newton-John song from back in the 80s, and presumably there'll be a roller derby arena in the place for people to go around wearing huge 1980s hairstyles and horrible shiny spandex.
It's a great way to injure yourself when you're 50, roller.
I don't know how you make that connection, Steve. It would
Which
be
one?
Fair. The one about rollerblades and big hair.
You never saw the film Xanadu, you lucky lady.
No, I just know the poem. In Xanadu did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure dome to decree, where Alf the sacred river ran through caverns measureless to man down to the sunless sea.
Liz, when you get home, get onto YouTube and look up Xanadu with Olivia Newton-John, and you'll have a whole...
Wanting to see it again now.
And you then pluck your eyeballs out afterwards, I promise you.
Okay.
Anyway, Liz's recollections are more refined than yours. She remembers Coleridge.
Yes.
But what do you think? I mean, if you're contravening the Human Rights Act here, why aren't you contravening it in a retirement village? They discriminate against people.
Though, I'm not sure that there's any age. You know, if you happen to be 62 and you want to move into a retirement village and you can afford to pay, I don't think there's any anything that you're not allowed to do. I spend a lot of time in retirement villages, not personally, but taking one of my dogs in. And, you know, there are a very wide range of people living in those.
Do retirement villages specifically say you must be over a certain age before you're allowed to? Or do they simply market them toward the...
Yeah.
I wish Michael Bott were here, because he would be able to clarify this, but there's an age of eligibility for retirement villages.
Oh, there is?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And so you do have to be 50 or 55
or 60.
That's
only government funding.
Okay, so in fact you can be 37 and move into a retirement village.
Yeah, and I mean...
They'd probably welcome you, because they'd like a fusion of youth.
It would diminish the average age by a significant amount.
But presumably, given that they are marketed toward the Blue Rinse Brigade, young people like yourself, Liz, wouldn't want to go there, presumably.
No, well, that's very kind of you, Steve, but I think I'm probably closer to it than you.
Does it really matter?
I mean,
irrespective of the letter of the law, which we perhaps cannot clarify today, does it really matter if you have an apartment complex set up for the over 50s and say, if you want to come in here...
No, and then let's do another one that's set up just, say, for only men. Okay, and then down the road we can have one that's set up just for white people. You know, where do we draw the line?
Well, if, I mean, I think that a group of us, friends, have been talking about buying something like a motel and just having us all in there as part of our retirement plan and having a conference venue which somebody will manage to bring in resource and a nurse that once we all get to the stage that we need that sort of help.
Yeah.
Now, you know, there would be some limits on who would be able to come into that. It would be people we know and like. And we've, you know, a number of have been talking about it at some length because we're not exactly excited by the idea of other alternatives.
A lot of Americans make those pacts, don't they? They live in mini retirement villages. They make a commitment to one another. They get the nurse in or the medical little medical clinic, and that's how they decide to live.
Yeah.
Ask Steve, how do women's only gyms get away with it then?
I have no idea.
Retirement villages, says the texter, are exempt from age discrimination laws. Had we Michael Bott in tow today, and mysteriously we don't. I don't know what's happened to
him. Has he disappeared?
He's disappeared.
He's checking into Xanadu.
He's been abducted by aliens.
He's weary of the workload and has gone to live in Xanadu. No, he lives in Wellington actually, but he's a human rights lawyer. But we'll leave that. And I'll move to what, no doubt the question will be answered in other media. I'll move on to what the panellists would like to talk about today. Today on board with us, Liz Bowen, clearly Steve McCabe. Steve McCabe, you first.
Well, since it's been school holidays recently, and as I said before, you know, I spent the entire summer therefore with my brain, you know, pretty much off the hook, really. I've not been having terribly deep thoughts. And one of the great things you get to do over the holidays is you get to relax a little bit. So I went to the pictures recently, and we saw American Hustle, which I don't believe Sarah McMullen's reviewed for yet.
She's going to do it tomorrow.
Oh, I get to beat
her. Don't entirely steal her thunder.
I get to beat her to the punch for a change. She always beats me. And I don't know if she'll get the right opinion this time, but my sense of it was, this is on the shortlist. It's been nominated for the Best Picture Oscar alongside things like Gravity and Captain Phillips and 12 Years a Slave, which I've not seen yet, but I definitely
It's Gravity's
want
main
to.
Rival, isn't it? American well, Hustle?
No. Dear Lord, I hope not. Because it was not very good. And I came away from it thinking, how did this make the shortlist? How did this get nominated?
Why is it not very good?
Well, here's the thing. I have a great fondness for what I thought this film was going to be. The crime caper, the sort of the multi-layered, deeply plotted, sharply scripted, tightly acted, snappy film. I mean, people like, oh, what's his name? I can't remember. I've forgotten the fella's name now.
You can't do that as a review. You can't say I've forgotten what the fella's name is.
You know, I was thinking about this in the car on the way up. I sort of rehearsed this in my head. And Guy Ritchie, there you go, did films like Snatch or Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. That's what I thought this was going to be in the genre of. And it's not exclusively British genre either. You know, the Americans do things like, say, the Ocean's 11, 12, 13 counting series. You know, they can do this kind of thing quite entertainingly as well, and that's what I thought I was going to get. And I got 2 hours of a rather baggy, rather meh, not very good film, and I just wonder what went wrong. How did, for example, Blue Jasmine, the new Woody Allen film, not make it into the shortlist when you got a phenomenal performance by Cate Blanchett? It's absolutely brilliant. One of the best films that I've seen in quite some time.
I'm still not clear what American Hustle is about. Amy Adams is in it, isn't she?
Yes, she is. It's kind of hard to say exactly what it is about. It's basically set in
isn't it?
Yes, it's about a con man who gets picked up by the feds and then told that he either goes to prison or he helps them run a scam to try and entrap further scammers.
Okay, so it's a bit like The Sting, in a sense, with Paul...
Yeah, an updated version of that, but it's based apparently on a true story. You know, the little gimmick at the very beginning, I think the opening black screen, white letters, is some of this actually happened. So it's allegedly based on a true story. And it's got so much potential, it should have been brilliant. I wanted it so much to be the most amazing film I'd seen in weeks, and it wasn't.
All right, you've got that off your chest.
Yes, I had a quick rant, sorry.
You've got that off your chest, thank you. The movie review by Steve McCabe. Liz Bowen, Cluely.
Well, there are two things that I wanted to talk about, and I'll talk about one, and then if I've got time, I'll talk about the other. The first one I've been pondering upon is Sochi, you know, the Winter Olympics. Mm-hmm. And I'm getting to the conclusion that I wonder whether or not the New Zealand Olympic organisation should actually be sending athletes over there for a couple of reasons. One, the whole issue around gay rights over there, but, you know, that's politics and sport. But frankly, the risk to athletes of terrorism seems to be growing by the day.
Don't worry about the first point. Some of Mr. Putin's best friends are gay.
Well, that's nice. But be that as it may, I'm not sure that our athletes should be being put in that level of danger. And I mean, the Americans are sending in warships into the waters so that they can evacuate people in the event of some form of attack. And I'm thinking, this is supposed to be the Winter Olympics. It's supposed to be entertainment. Now, I know Steve's told us that, you know, the film he saw wasn't entertainment, but at least he wasn't going to be shot by terrorists.
But it's drama, isn't it? It's the Ring of Steel. It's what the world laps up.
Yeah.
The Olympics have been, you know, for decades, tainted in some shape or form by
various... This just seems to be more dangerous. I mean, all of the Stans, I think, have got together, along with some of the others, and like Chechnya and things, and they are setting themselves up to really do something very nasty. So that was my first thing. Mm-hmm. The second was that I've come to the conclusion that organics, i.e. organic milk, organic this, organic that, is a giant marketing con.
It's a somewhat, it's a fairly sweeping accusation.
I know. We drove past a shop the other day which had organic milk, a sign for, and Greg and I were sort of talking about it. And one of the things that always strikes me about organic is that you can not put all of those nasties on your product. But New Zealand poured DDT, 245T, goodness knows what else, into the ecosystem in this country for from the 1950s on, really until into the 1990s, and still some of it today. Now, we're also a nation, we're an island nation, which means that we have wind. And wind tends to pick up soil and subsoil and deposit it in various other places. And I was just thinking, how can you be sure? And I'm sure somebody will tell me that they measure all of this and that and the other thing. But if you're an ecologically sound organic producer living next door to somebody who isn't, how can you be sure that that isn't affecting you? How can you be sure that the polluted subsoil is not impacting on your product?
Aren't you relegating to negligible the best eco efforts of noble organicists who've been working on organics for a couple of decades just on the basis of, you know, someone else's trace elements in soil?
Yes.
And also, is that fair of you to do that?
Probably not.
Okay.
And also, this word organic is somewhat spurious anyway. An organic chemical is anything that's got is based on carbon chain chemistry. So all your DDT and the like, that's organic chemicals you're putting in the soil there. This word organic is basically whatever I want it to mean today. And a lot of the food that's being sold as organic is nothing of the sort anyway. The honey I get out of my beehive is absolutely pure. That would presumably be organic. Stuff that's being offered for sale in the shops, even if it's labelled organic, is still going to be pasteurised.
Okay, so you're both organic cynics.
A little bit.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's a giant marketing con to make me pay more to feel better. Now, free range I'm okay about, but organic I have my real doubts about.
Are you sure, when you buy free range, are you sure how free the range is?
Well, you know, I have pictures of happy pigs, you know, who've been put out into the pasture, of happy chooks who are chunking away there, and I feel better for it.
So this is like in the movie Babe, is your notion of free range.
But when I see small, wizened fruit being and vegetables being sold to me at incredibly high and inflated prices, my cynicism just sort of rears.
I'm not totally sure how it works in this country. I know back in the US where I used to live, organic, for the longest time, I don't know if it does now, had no official legal definition. And anyone can claim that anything is organic. Do we have in this country an official designation or the definition of what organic is?
Yeah, I think we do. There's all sorts of, you know, organic licensing processes and things, aren't there?
And then how watered down has that definition become?
I have no idea.
I mean, my wife put out some slug slam to go on the cabbages a few weeks ago. Does that mean that we're no longer raising organic cabbages?
Absolutely.
I would think not.
Yeah, terrible, isn't it?
Thank you very much, both of you.
I suspect that the emails are coming in now.
Yes, they are, and some of them contain strong language, and some of them are agreeing with you, as is the norm. An extra 58,000 motorists were caught speeding because of the lowered speed limit tolerance at holiday weekends in the past 2 years. So that's 2 years' worth, and the police are not ruling out making the policy permanent. Speed tolerance normally 110 k's above the limit. Since Queen's birthday weekend 2010 has been lowered to 4 k's, as you know, for holiday weekends when traffic volumes are higher. So the lower threshold currently being trialled outside holiday weekends for the first time, and the assessment period began on December 1, will end on January 31, when police will decide whether it could become permanent. We've had a 60-year low in the road toll for 2013. So what are the chances, do you think, the police will decide to permanently adopt lowered tolerance, and would you favour it?
Well, I think what... you know, I said I did that quick sprint between Wellington and Auckland to pick up the dog. And so we went up on one day and came back on the next. And I was really interested because we have this limiter on the car. So we set it at 104. And except when we were sort of passing people, we tended to keep it there. Now, the number of people that were trundling past us at speeds that were a great deal higher than 104 was quite interesting. And there were a number of accidents that may well have happened because of it. So I suppose my feeling is if it saves one life, it's worth it, isn't it?
Entire national policy for over many years saves one life?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a very simplistic way of looking at things. Speed can be dangerous, and the faster you get, the more dangerous it can become. But if we simply have an arbitrary limit, and we go with 100 because it's a nice round number, it's easy to measure, but that's not in and of itself what causes accidents. It might compound the accidents, it might make the consequences of the accident more severe, but simply travelling at 110 kilometres an hour versus 100 does not make you inherently a more dangerous driver. The Germans have been demonstrating this for years. It's very, very simple, and it's very, very absolute, and it's easy in court to produce the evidence. Look, here's the speeding, the measurement from the speed camera. You were travelling at 105, you broke the law, you get hit with a fine. It's very, very cut and dried. It's a lot harder to make a case of dangerous driving, and as a result, we tend not to use that as the offence quite so much. But that's what kills, more than simply speed.
Okay, but before we hear from Hamish Pearcey, if keeping speed down, if the causes of traffic accidents, as you say, are many and various, and to some extent many of them are ignored, but if keeping speed down does ameliorate the effects of other bad driving, if we accept that hypothesis for a moment, is it still then legitimate to make us all drive more slowly, irrespective of whether conditions warrant it or not? I mean, is it still a good policy, even though it ignores other bad driving, as you say?
It's an easy policy. It's a very easy one to police. You mention... regarding the conditions, one thing that we might want to consider is something that I've seen, and this was in place 15 years ago in Japan, where speed limits on motorways vary depending on the conditions. And the speed limit on most motorways there is 100 k's. In bad weather, the limit is dropped to 80. Maybe we might want to consider, say, on the southern motorway coming out of Auckland, we might want to say raise the limit to 120 on a good, clear day.
What, go like hell today?
120 isn't going like hell, though, really, is it, to be perfectly honest? If the traffic's not ridiculously heavy, and the road surface is dry, and the visibility is good, 120 is not a dangerous speed. In dodgy weather, when the visibility is reduced, and you've got spray from mist off and rain off the roads, then lowering the limit to 80 or 70 is prudent. We might want to have a variable limit.
Okay, that's an interesting suggestion. Liz, just before we hear from Hamish, do you think that's sensible?
Well, I do think it's sensible, but I also am aware that when I was in South Africa, the speed limit over there on the motorways was 120. Now, the chances were that anybody driving on there would be doing between 120 and 160. And the road traffic accidents over there were absolutely horrendous. And I suppose, you know, if you're going to set a limit and it's not a variable limit, such as Steve's suggesting, and I think that that's not such a stupid idea, then, you know, either it's the limit or it isn't. And so, you know, now we've got a tolerance up to 110. Well, then the speed limit's 110. So if you make it 110, then people will drive at 120. So you've got to put a line in the sand, I think, and say, well, if it's 100, it's 100. If it's 110, it's 110. But if you go above those things, then you're going to be pinged.
Okay. Hamish Pearcey is a crash investigator and a road safety consultant and is kindly joining us now. Hamish, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. 58,000, a lot of extra traffic tickets. Are they effective, do you think, Hamish?
As far as raising revenue, yes. I think the aim behind it, though, is to try and achieve an overall average reduction in speed, and that's where that policy comes in. However, does it actually achieve a realistic result in lowering a road toll? Probably harder to establish, especially considering road safety design improvements and also vehicle safety.
Okay, so, I mean, we have lots of listeners who say all they're doing is catching motorist after motorist on safe, long stretches of highway and getting revenue. And so you would essentially agree with that argument?
There is an element you can agree with, yeah. I fail to see, you know, the years I've been involved in crash investigation and road safety and intending motor vehicle crashes, the times that you see a speed camera at a crash location is rare. More often they're at passing lanes, straight stretches of road, where you're probably more likely to have a fatigue-related crash than you are a speed one. But the other factor is driver education, and that is, are we actually teaching our drivers to drive at speed safely? If you look at the international experience, the driver education is probably taken a lot more seriously than I think we do in New Zealand. And the other factor is that you can spend a majority of your year travelling at sort of 50 to 70 to 80 k's around urban areas, and then it comes to a holiday weekend and you get on a 100 k road and away you go. Yeah. And that is an entirely different ballgame.
Okay, so you're saying, are you, that we're a nation of uneducated and maybe not as skilled drivers, but given that, is it a sensible policy by the police then to try and keep a lid on our lack of skill by slowing us all down?
Well, speed, and the accuracy of speedos comes into it as well. I mean, you're reliant on this device in your car to tell you that accurately you're going a particular speed.
Yeah.
Most vehicles these days are built in with an inherent inaccuracy. In other words, they could be up to 5 kilometres an hour out. Meaning that when your speedo says you're doing 100, you could be doing anything between 95 and 105. More particularly, you're probably doing slower speed. But when you start getting a tolerance of about only 4 kilometres an hour, then you start having factors like tyre pressure and tyre size, and all those things start to become quite important, because it changes the rolling diameter of your tyre, which will therefore increase or decrease your speed, depending whether you're overinflated or underinflated.
Police probably don't think a lot of these will be challenged in court, though, because of the time and trouble involved.
No, that's quite right. The other factor, too, is that is it safe for police to do a U-turn in a highway, pursue someone where they're actually probably well, truly exceeding 120, maybe 130 kilometres an hour, to catch up with a motorist who's doing 104, 105, pull them over and give them a ticket. So I think you could almost argue that is it actually a safe, from that point of view, that the police actually can carry out enforcement for a low-end speeding offence when they actually have to potentially exceed the speed limit, well and truly exceed the speed limit themselves in order to enforce it.
There's a way to solve this argument. I've just been sitting here pondering it while I listen to you, and that is just remove all speed limits and then see what happens. So if the traffic, if we have more crashes, it will prove that speed limits do have an effect, and if we have the same amount or fewer, it will prove that they don't.
Well, we would have more crashes, wouldn't we? Because there'd be madmen on the roads trying to drive their Nissan Skylines at 200 k's an hour.
But there are already.
Well, only the odd one.
To a degree, you would have that, but you would have a levelling out of speeds on particular roads. And a driver who's travelling faster than the flow of traffic on a road is bound to get caught up in slower moving traffic in the end and be forced to slow to that traffic speed. I think in real terms, we've actually got to look at the slower driver on the road, because they're often the one who creates a situation where you have impatient overtaking. The passing lane situation where you finally get a passing lane and every man and his dog puts his foot down.
Yeah.
So I think if we're going to see an increasing level of enforcement of 4K tolerance by police, I think we need to see an increasing level of enforcement for slow and inconsiderate drivers.
All right.
And similarly, I think we need to see it as a public education campaign on TV as well, to actually portray that issue, because if we have an upper-end enforcement, then I think there needs to be a level of enforcement publicised for those who particularly create dangers by travelling slower.
Thank you, Hamish. Hamish Pearcey, crash investigator, road safety consultant. Did you want a last word?
Yes, it's just one thing that does strike me. When I'm going to drive home tonight, I'll drive back down through Highway 22 into Pukekohe, and I take a little turn off just before I get into Pukekohe, and I go through a winding country lane, and because it meets certain criteria for number of premises alongside, that road has a limit of 100 kilometres an hour. You would have to be insane, or possibly your putative Skyline driver, to actually hit 100 down that road.
Yeah, there are a few roads like that.
Yeah, it's simply because it meets a certain number of criteria. I can be driving at the same speed on that road as I can on the Southern Motorway. Yeah. This makes no sense at all.
Yeah, and people do wonder that. Okay, thank you. Just before we go, we were talking about Kate Blanchett's objection to the cameras on the women's gowns on the red carpet. Channel 7's defended the dating question that interviewer Samantha Smith fired at teenage tennis sensation Eugenie Bouchard, accused of sexism. Now, it may have been a daft question. Was it sexist? She was asking, who would you date? Well, and I don't know if you've seen it, but she thinks a bit about this question.
Yeah, but she also asked her about the match, about her coach's advice, her composure, her next opponent, the Genie Army, and then she asked her that question. I mean, if you're expecting an interview on court after this type of thing to be in-depth journalism, I think you're going to be sadly disappointed. And yes, it was probably not the most intelligent question, but I don't think that you can call it sexist.
Okay, it's an interesting point. Do you agree?
It was a completely mindless and inane question, but it's what you ask a teenager. I think more worrying is the answer she gave.
Yeah, Justin Bieber.
Justin Bieber.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's sad.
He's an eligible young man. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well,
and highly successful.
Well, maybe you can start throwing tennis balls instead of eggs.
Steve McCabe, thank you. Good luck with the school year.
Thank you very much.
Liz Bowen-Cludy, good luck with Archie.
Thank you very much, Jim. You're welcome to come and visit him.
The lovely Archie. And Liz and Steve on the panel again soon enough. And we are back soon enough, which will be tomorrow. Thanks, everybody. Checkpoint following.